Thank you, Shavid. That was beautiful. Appreciate that very much. Well, it's Mother's Day weekend. When my wife and I first got married, I told her on our first Mother's Day, she wasn't a mother yet, wouldn't be for 4 years, and I said, you know, you'll be a mother someday. So we always just kept the weekend of it, and she eventually became a mother of three beautiful children. So, you know, my wife comes from, I think I've mentioned this, up the Hollers in northeastern Kentucky. It's deep in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. To get to her house, you go down this blacktop road to a two-lane gravel road to a one-lane blacktop road to one-and-a-half-lane gravel road to two tracks in the dirt that occasionally gets a little bit of gravel on it, and then you reach your house. I tell people when I first would describe it to people what her house, getting to her house was like, it was up a holler, up a holler, up a holler. You go so far back in there. But you know, at one time those hollers had moonshine. I mean, they would run across moonshine stills, broken up ones by now, and they grew a lot of tobacco in those places. Well, if you go back into those hollers, up one of the hollers, there's this huge, or was this huge poplar tree. And on that huge poplar tree that was quite old, where it was the history and the loves and the lives and the kindreds and the family that my wife's family was. Back in the 1960s, her mom and dad etched a heart in the bark of that poplar tree, put their initials in it. Back in the late 1970s, I etched a heart in that poplar tree, and I have my wife's and my initials in there. If you go back there, you can find the initials of all of my children and my children's cousins and various other people of her family. And it's something we don't tend to do that much anymore. You don't see a lot of people carving initials anymore like they used to. It was a way at one time that you kept your legacy alive. You'd carve your initials because that would last for centuries in a tree. And you would dedicate your love to somebody by putting your initials in the middle of a heart, and you'd say RK plus ES. And that pledged your love. As fathers and mothers, we can etch our legacy, our love, and our care in our children in a way that even goes beyond what we do when we etch these initials in a tree. It's easy to carve initials in a tree. It's more difficult as parents to carve our life, our way of life, into our children's lives. But that's what's important, that we do, that we carve into our children's life, into their minds and their hearts, God's way of life. Tomorrow is Mother's Day here in the U.S., and it's a time where we celebrate and honor the mothers that are amongst us. All their sacrifice and their hard work, their love and their care that they've given to us, raising us as children. They can have a tremendous influence on their children and on the rest of us. Mothers have a certain care and love that's important. Important as we raise families. And what I'd like to do today is go through four mothers that we find in the book of Hebrews, mainly in the book of Hebrews, or in the chapter 11 of Hebrews, and we'll glean some lessons off of that. We're actually not going to go there quite right away, but we'll eventually find ourselves there. But we can learn lessons from these mothers that we'll read in there, and as we delve deeper into their lives, we can learn lessons as mothers. You can learn lessons from them. But there are also those who aren't mothers yet that can learn lessons. But there are people like me who will never be a mother, but I can learn some important lessons from these women in the Bible. These women I'll call women of faith and belief, something that we all need to become. Proverbs 14:1 in the Contemporary English Version says this: a woman's family is held together by her wisdom, but it can be destroyed by her foolishness. A mother has an incredible role in the family and in society. It's an incredible role. Her wisdom is really important. You know, there's a poem that was written in the 19th century by poet William Ross Wallace that reminds us of the importance of women in society and how incredibly important they are in our lives. In 1865, he released this poem. Its name is What Rules the World. You may not have heard it, you may have heard it, but I'm sure when I come to the one stanza in it that just about everybody's heard, you'll remember it. I'll read two stanzas from it. It says, what rules the world? Blessings on the hand of women. Angels guard its strength and grace. In the palace, cottage, hovel, oh, no matter where the place. Would that never storms assailed it, rainbows ever gently curled. For the hand that rocks the cradle is the hand that rules the world. Women, how divine your mission here upon our natal soil. Keep, oh keep the young heart open always to the breath of God. All true trophies of the ages are from mother love imperiled. For the hand that rocks the cradle is the hand that rules the world. The hand that rocks the cradle is the hand that rules the world. That's the importance that a mother has on their children. An incredible important job and responsibility, and something that their children will live with forever in their life. And a good mother will raise good children, and they will be the ones that rule the world, but the mother will still be behind them in her lessons. True motherhood is a gift from God. It's created by God as an important cornerstone of families and even as of society as a whole. We're called to respect and honor our mothers. The fifth commandment tells us, honor your mother and your father, that your days may be long. It comes with a promise that our days may be long in the land. Proverbs 6, verses 20 and 21. Proverbs 6, 20 and 21 remind us of the importance of following the wisdom and training of wise and righteous parents. Proverbs 6, 20 and 21. Proverbs 6, verse 20 says, my son, keep your father's command and do not forsake the law of your mother. Verse 21, bind them continually upon your heart. Tie them around your neck. Verse 22. When you roam, they will lead you. When you sleep, they will keep you. And when you wake, they will speak with you. Verse 23. For the commandment is a lamp and the law a light. We're to hold to the law and wisdom of our mothers and of our fathers. We're supposed to put it in high esteem. Abraham Lincoln once said, no one is poor who has a godly mother. Let's turn to Proverbs 1, 8, and 9. It says something similar to the Proverbs 8 that I read, or 6 that I read earlier. Proverbs 1, verse 8 says, my son, hear the instruction of your father and do not forsake the law of your mother. For they will be graceful ornaments on your head and chains upon your neck. They will do good for you. They will help you through life. The New Living Translation translates verse 9 as, what you learn from them will crown you with grace and clothe you with honor. I don't know how many read my message to you this Sabbath that I sent out on Friday, I told you my mom was the meanest mom in the world. She was. She fed me well when a lot of other kids my age got to eat sugary stuff for breakfast. She made me be home at decent times of night rather than out with my friends through all hours of the night. She had laws and rules that I had to live by. She taught me God. She had us do Bible study every night. She taught me things. She was mean to me. But when I looked around at my other friends as I reached the middle and late high school, I realized that that wasn't meanness. That was love spelled in all capital letters. She truly loved us and cared about us. And she was raising us in that way. And as I grew older, how she taught me helped to be a chain around my neck, a good one, an ornament. The instructions we receive from godly parents help us build character and personality within us that will carry us far and will keep us out of a lot of trouble, will give us a light yoke, as we were told. It'll make life easier for us. About 15 years ago, I purchased this poster. It was about 3.5 feet tall, and I hung it up in my office room because I was in a common room, and I would hire, up working at United Church of God, I would hire ABC students to help me in my computer area. And I hung this poster up on the wall because I thought it was so full of really wise wisdom. Now, it wasn't necessarily out of the Bible, but every single principle was biblical. And I hope they would read it and look at it and learn from it and incorporate some of what they saw in that. The poster was called 21 Suggestions for Success. It was written by H. Jackson Brown. And he lists 21 physical things that we can do to be successful. They were like, marry the right person. This one decision will determine 90% of your happiness or misery in life. These kids that were coming in here at ABC, they were going to get married some point in the future. And I thought that was an important thing for them to understand because that will help with a happy life. Physically, that's an important thing. It had other points like be forgiving of yourself and others, be generous, have a grateful heart, commit yourselves to constant improvement, be honest, take responsibility for every area of your life. And at the end of the list, there were 21 pieces. Number 21, suggestion 21, was this: don't do anything that wouldn't make your mom proud. Don't do anything that wouldn't make your mom proud. And I looked at it and I thought, you know, we compare ourselves against God and against Christ, but often our moms are something we can compare ourselves with. If we're making our moms proud, and especially if they're godly moms, that's good. So I thought, you know, this is really a good thing. Don't do anything that wouldn't make your mom proud. Something that they could look at as they were thinking about maybe as a young 20, 21-year-old person, some decisions they'd have to make in life. Maybe they'd think back to that poster and look at that. As I said, Jesus Christ and God the Father are real things which we compare against. We want to make them proud. But this number 21 is not far off the mark of what we read in the Bible. If we go to Proverbs 23, Proverbs 23, verses beginning in verse 22, it says, listen to your father who begot you, and do not despise your mother when she is old. Verse 23, buy the truth and do not sell it. Also, wisdom and instruction and understanding. The father of the righteous will greatly rejoice, and he who begets a wise child will delight in him. Verse 25, let your father and mother be glad, and let her who bore you rejoice. This is basically what that suggestion 21 is saying. Allow your mom to rejoice in you. Let her be happy in you. Let her be proud in you. That's what Proverbs 23:25 is saying. Let mom rejoice in you because of how you're living your life. Make mom proud. Make mom proud. So the Bible contains several examples of mothers that we can look at and gain from and learn from. In Hebrews 11, we read of four different women, four different mothers. Women of faith and belief. Two very strong characteristics that they had, faith and belief. If we turn to Hebrews 11, we'll begin in verses 11 and 12. Hebrews 11, verses 11 and 12, we'll read. Read about Sarah, a mother who through faith bore Isaac, long after she should have been able to have. Hebrews 11, beginning in verse 11, it says, by faith Sarah herself also received strength to conceive seed, as she bore a child when she was past the age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. Verse 12, therefore from one man and him as good as dead, that's talking of Abraham, but Sarah was, as far as having children, she was as good as dead also. She wasn't able to have children at the age she was. And him as good as dead were born as many as the stars of the sky in multitude, innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore. So it is through Sarah and Abraham that all these people exist. This miracle that occurred. But in verse 11, we can read some of the characteristics that identify who Sarah was. The first is, it says, by faith she received strength. By faith she received strength. She received the strength to be able to have a child, to be able to conceive, to carry out the work of a mother. And it was done by faith. She had great faith in God. God is our strength. God's our source of strength, our source of comfort. It should be ours too, just like it was Sarah's. We need to have faith that God will also keep his promises. And that's the second point we see in this scripture. Was promise. It says, because she judged him, God, faithful who had promised. She believed. She believed that God would be faithful, that God would do what he promised. The New Living Translation translates this as, she believed that God would keep his promises. He would do what he promised. So God was not only Sarah's source of strength, but from God she received her future. Source of something she could believe in. Now we might at the start take a look at that and say, well, wait a second. Didn't Sarah laugh? She didn't believe. She laughed. She laughed. Genesis 18:11. She laughed. Well, Genesis 18:11 goes through that part of the story. In Genesis 18:11, we read, now Abraham and Sarah were old, well advanced in age. I believe they were probably in their 90s here. And Sarah had passed the age of childbearing. Verse 12, therefore Sarah laughed within herself, saying, after I have grown old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also? Verse 13, and the Lord said to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh, saying, shall I surely bear a child since I am old? And then in verse 14, God asks, is anything too hard for the Lord? At the appointed time, I will return to you according to the time of life, and Sarah shall have a son. So at this point, Sarah laughed because this was impossible. How could it ever happen? But Sarah changed and believed. She changed and believed. Her laughter originally was one of unbelief and skepticism. But if we go to Genesis 21:6, this is after Sarah gave birth to Isaac. We read this, Genesis 21:6. We see laughter again. Genesis 21:6, it says, and Sarah said, God has made me to laugh. Now this word laugh here can also have the meaning of made laughter for me, or granted me the ability to laugh and rejoice. That's what that statement can be translated also, because at this point in life she was rejoicing, and all who hear will laugh and rejoice with me. So her original laughter changed to one of belief. Of course, she had a child. She would believe. But that skeptical laugh turned into a laughter of joy and rejoicing at the fulfillment of what God had promised her, a child, something she originally laughed at because she didn't think it could ever happen. Now she's laughing because it's fulfilled. She believes. So by faith, God was able to do the impossible through Sarah, to make a nation. Sarah is an example of a mother of faith and a mother who believed in promises. Remember, that's what it called her, what it said about her. She's a mother of faith and belief. If we look at verse 23 of Hebrews, go back to Hebrews 11:23. We can read about her second mother that we read of in Hebrews 11. These are those faithful heroes that we have recorded for us in the Bible. Hebrews 11:23. We read of Moses' mother and father. Hebrews 11:23. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child and they were not afraid of the king's command. By faith, Moses' parents hid him. By faith, they hid that newborn baby. Now, in Hebrews, we're not told who this woman is. We just know it's the mother of Moses. But in Numbers 26, we have one of the places where we read who it is, what her name is. Numbers 26, verse 59, it says this. The name of Amram's wife was Jochebed. Jochebed. The daughter of Levi, who was born to Levi in Egypt. And to Amram, she bore Aaron and Moses and their sister Miriam. So it's Jochebed was the name of this mother. And her name means God is glory. God is glory. We know the story of Moses. You can turn back to Exodus 1. But I'll give you a little summary of it. There was a small group of Hebrews, this Hebrew clan, that came into Egypt because there was a great famine in the land of Canaan. And there was a man named Jacob who had sent his sons down into Egypt to get grain because there had been this wise person in Egypt who had saved up grain for all this time. And they could buy grain during this famine in Egypt. So they go down to Egypt and various things happen where sons don't come back to this father, Jacob. And eventually they find out that this is Joseph, one of Jacob's sons. So Joseph invites them down to Egypt. The whole family come down. And they're treated very well by the Egyptians at this point. But then over time, the Egyptians forget about all that had been done by this man, Joseph. And they begin to worry about this large group of foreigners that are in this country, and they make them slaves. And they mandate that all male children must be killed. Let's go ahead and continue this story in Exodus 1, verse 15. It says, the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name of one was Shiprah, and the name of the other was Paha. Verse 16, and he said, when you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stools, if it is a son, then you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live. If you read down, verse 22 tells us that they were killed by throwing them into the Nile River and drowning them. I may wonder why. What's the story behind this? Well, Josephus writes us a little bit of the story behind some of this, and it's interesting to read it. It's quite possibly historically true, but we find out from Josephus in the Antiquities of the Jews why the Pharaoh wanted to kill all these male babies. And this is what Josephus writes. A sacred scribe, a sacred Egyptian scribe, told the Pharaoh of Egypt that a child would be born to the Israelites, who, if reared, would bring about the downfall of the Egyptians and would increase the Israelites. The child would also have great virtue and would obtain a glory that would be remembered through all ages. Because of this prophecy, he continues, Pharaoh determined to kill all Hebrew boys, so this prophecy could not come to pass. Kind of reminds you of something in the New Testament, doesn't it? When they tried to kill Jesus by killing all the babies in Bethlehem. But we know that God, if he has a prophecy, it will not fail. If he's going to bring something to pass required by his plan, mankind, humankind cannot stop it. Because of this prophecy, Pharaoh determined to kill all Hebrew boys, so this prophecy could not come to pass. Josephus includes a few more details about Pharaoh's edict to kill all newborn boys. The Pharaoh's command to kill all babies included a warning to all parents that might try to hide their newborn boy. If they were caught, the entire family would be killed, not just the baby boy. So that's the background to this part of this story. So in Exodus 2, verse 1, we continue the story. A man of the house of Levi went and took a wife, a daughter of Levi. So the woman conceived. Stop right there. You've heard the edict come out from Pharaoh that all boys had to be killed. And you've just conceived. Can you imagine the turmoil that you'd be going through at this point in time? Would I bear a boy child that I would watch die? Or would I bear a girl child who could live? Would my whole family, would I hold back this baby, hide this baby, and possibly my whole family be killed because of that? You know, how difficult would that be? Josephus gives us some more insight. Josephus talks about an event that happened after Jochebed had conceived, but before she gave birth. He writes this again in the Antiquity of the Jews. He says, a man whose name was Amram, one of the nobler sort of Hebrews, was afraid for his whole nation, lest it should fail by the want of young men to be brought up hereafter, and was very uneasy at it, his wife being then with child. And he knew not what to do. And he does the right thing. It says, thereupon he betook himself to prayer to God. Accordingly, God had mercy on him and was moved by his supplication. He stood by him in his sleep and exhorted him not to despair. And this is what God tells Amram from Josephus' story. God lets him know this: know therefore that I shall provide for you all what is good for what is for your good, and particularly for yourself what shall make you famous. For that child, out of dread of whom the Egyptians have doomed the Israelite children to destruction, all the boys, shall be your child. In other words, that one prophesied about was going to be their child. And shall be conceived from those who watch to or concealed from those who watch to destroy him. And when he is brought up in a surprising way, I think it's funny God puts in this interesting little note there. Hey, he's going to be brought up in a different way. I mean, who would have ever thought that Moses would be brought up as an Egyptian? That would be pretty surprising to me. When he is brought up in a surprising way, he shall deliver the Hebrew nation from the distress they are under from the Egyptians. His memory shall be famous while the world lasts. And this not only among the Hebrews, but foreigners too. So Amram told this dream to his wife. She now knew that this man, this boy child she was carrying, would be taken care of. He'd be provided for. He'd be safe. Continuing in Exodus 2:2, it says, so the woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a beautiful child, she hid him 3 months. But when she could no longer hide him, she took an ark of bulrushes for him, dabbed it with asphalt and pitch, put the child in it, and laid it in the reeds by the riverbank. Verse 4, and his sister stood afar off to know what would be done to him. She had been told, and Amram had been told, that he'd be taken care of. But Josephus adds just a little piece here. He says, fearing that Moses would be discovered, his parents determined that it was time to trust the safety and care of the child to God, and to fully believe that God could bring to pass what he had promised. We see, just like Sarah, Moses' mother was a mother of faith and belief. She had faith that God would take care of this child, and she had belief that God would care and bring to pass what he had promised. Can you imagine if that was your child, putting it in a little basket and putting it out in the river and letting it float down the river? I can't imagine what my thoughts would have been as I kissed that baby Moses for the last time, possibly. You know, it would have been difficult, but they had faith and belief. And they had Miriam follow that basket. And scholars think she may have been about 14 years old at the time, but she followed it, and she followed it down to where the princess, the Egyptian princess, was bathing. And the Egyptian princess sees this basket and goes over and takes a look inside and sees this beautiful child and decides to keep it. Well, Josephus adds an interesting note here again about what happened at this point. Because Josephus says that the princess, the Egyptian princess, immediately apparently brought some nursing mothers to the baby to try to have it nurse the baby. And the baby would not nurse from any Egyptian woman. So Miriam, according to Josephus, went up to the princess and said, I know somebody who might be able to nurse the baby. And of course, that was her mother. And immediately, the baby nursed. So even that, God caused Moses to not nurse from the Egyptian women. This allowed Amram and Jochebed to be able to keep Moses, little Moses, until he was weaned at probably the age of 3. I bet Amram and Jochebed probably told Moses all kinds of stories while they had Moses in their household. You wonder if those stories, even though he was only 3 when he left the house, maybe some of those stories came back to remembrance later on in his life. But it's because of that that Amram and Jochebed could keep the baby until it was 3 years old. Joseph's mother, Jochebed, again, was a woman of faith and belief. Strong faith and strong belief to be able to let her child go and believe and have faith in God, that God would take care and would fulfill his promises, just like Sarah had faith and belief. A third woman in her mother in Hebrews 11 that we'll look at, going back to Hebrews 11, verse 31, is Rahab. Rahab. Now you might say, how can Rahab be an example of a good mother? Well, we'll look. Hebrews 11, verse 31. It says, by faith, the harlot Rahab did not perish with those who did not believe when she had received the spies with peace. In that scripture alone, we see 2 attributes of Rahab. By faith, she didn't perish with those who did not believe, which meant she believed. By faith and by belief, she did not perish. We find the story of Rahab in Joshua 2. In Joshua 2, the story of Rahab is probably could make a great movie. It's an incredible story of faith and works, of change, of sin and intrigue and spies and lies and armies and battles and miracles and repentance and redemption. It's a story of faith and belief. Rahab was a Canaanite woman. She lived in Jericho, who through faith believed God and provided a means for the escape of the spies that had come into Jericho to spy out the city before the destruction of Jericho. And here we have this Canaanite woman who's a Gentile, an idol worshiper, and yet we see that she was saved by faith and belief. Rahab's reputation was as a harlot, as a prostitute. And there are some people who say, well, okay, she really wasn't that. She really was an innkeeper or a tavern keeper, because that word translated in human can mean that. It can be translated that way. Because they want to kind of lessen in some ways the change that Rahab had to go through. But no, she's exactly what you think she was. Because when Paul and James talk about Rahab the harlot, the Greek word means what all of us think it means. It does not mean an innkeeper. It does not mean a tavern keeper. She had to make a huge change in her life to believe and to have faith, to come from a life of sin to a life of righteousness. She had to be transformed into something that God could use, and it was because of her belief and her faith that she was able to do that. Let's go ahead and review that part of that story in Joshua 2. Beginning in verse 1, it says, now Joshua the son of Nun sent out 2 men from an acacia grove to spy secretly, saying, go view the land, especially Jericho. So they went, these spies did, and came to the house of a harlot named Rahab and lodged there. Verse 2, and it was told the king of Jericho, saying, behold, men have come here tonight from the children of Israel to search out the country. Verse 3, so the king of Jericho sent to Rahab, saying, bring out the men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search out all the country. Now Rahab has a choice here. What does she do? Does she hide the men? Does she give them up to the king for maybe this great reward and great prestige? What does she do? Verse 4, then the woman took the two men and hid them. So she said, this is what she says to the king, yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from. And it happened as the gate was being shut when it was dark that the men went out. Where the men went, I don't know. Pursue them quickly, for you may overtake them. In verse 6, but she had brought them up to the roof and hidden them with the stalks of flax, which she had laid in order on the roof. She decides to protect the spies and hides them on the roof of her house. You know, it's quite possible, again, just like with Moses, if the king had found out about this, not just she, but her whole household may have been killed. It was a difficult decision, but she did it. And why does she do this? Verse 8. Now, before they lay down, these are the two spies up on the roof, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, I know that the Lord has given you the land, that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you. Verse 10, for we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. Verse 11, and as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted. Neither did there remain any more courage in anyone because of you. Now we could say she's doing this just because she's afraid and she's wanting to be on the winning side, the side where the strongest army would be. But it continues here and it says, for the Lord your God, he is God. He is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. Her heart melted, I'm sure, too, but she realized that God was God. The rest of the people in Jericho apparently didn't. They knew they had this great God up there, but they weren't willing to repent or change or do anything else. But we see that she realizes, recognizes, and states that he is God in heaven above and earth beneath. She is willing to change her life. She has come to believe and have faith in God. She is another woman of faith and belief. Faith and belief that God was the God of Israel and the God of heaven and earth, and she was willing to do something about that. She begins to trust and believe in God, that's God of Israel, and she's willing to put her life out in belief that this God could save her and protect her. And she does it by active work. She shows her belief and her faith in actions. Come with me to James 2. James 2, verse 14. James 2, 14. Because we show our faith by our works. James 2, 14. What does it profit, my brethren, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can faith save him? Verse 15, if a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you says to them, depart in peace, be warmed and filled, but you do not give them the things which are needed for the body, what does it profit? Verse 17, thus also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. But someone will say, you have faith and I have works. And then James responds, show me your faith without your works, and I'll show you my faith by my works. That's exactly what Rahab did. She was showing her faith by her works. Verse 21, was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered Isaac his son on the altar? Verse 22, do you see that faith was working together with his works, and by works faith was made perfect? Now drop down to verse 25, and we'll see the connection to Rahab here. Verse 25, likewise, was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out another way? James uses Rahab as an example of faith, of true faith, of somebody who believed and had faith in God and put it into action. She didn't just tell the spies, hey, I know a way out of here, or be careful, they're after you. She put her faith into action and hid them and helped them get away. Now, this is usually where the story of Rahab stops. But Rahab's not a mother yet. This is before she's a mother. But she's preparing for it. But let's take a look at the rest of her life. Let's see what her legacy is as a mother of faith and belief. In the years after the destruction of Jericho, Rahab marries an Israelite named Salmon, who was a very prominent member of the tribe of Judah. In order to be able to marry this man, she probably had to be keeping God's way, because at that time, Israel was keeping God's way. To marry somebody prominent, you would have had to change and become, in effect, an Israelite. She marries this man, Salmon, prominent man. Together, Salmon and Rahab have a son. A son who is upright and honorable, named Boaz. Named Boaz, who married Ruth, whose descendants include King David and Jesus Christ. This is the legacy of this woman of faith and belief. She apparently taught her children well. And that carried down through the generations. This woman who had been a harlot changed and became an example of faith and belief. There's one more mother I'd like to take a look at. It's in the book of Hebrews also, and that's our mother, the church, the spiritual church. Because we have a mother in the spiritual church. And the spiritual church is not only our mother, but we are part of that. We make up that spiritual church. The church is a spiritual mother. It's those of us who are called by God and put into the spiritual church. We're part of this spiritual mother of all of us. I could go through quite a bit of time going through the passages that show that the church is the mother of us all, but I'll just hit a few points. Galatians 4, 21 through 26 talk about the old covenant and the new covenant. And Hagar, who represents the old covenant, and Sarah, who represents the new covenant. And Paul's talking about this very detailed information. And one thing he says in verse 26, he refers to the new covenant when he says, Jerusalem above who is free, which is the mother of us all. Who is the mother of us all. In Hebrews 12, verse 22 through 24, we read another connection between the church, Jerusalem, and the like. Hebrews 12, verse 22 says, "But you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels, and to the general assembly and church of the firstborn who are registered in heaven." That's us, church of the firstborn who are registered in heaven. "To God, the judge of all, to the spirits of just men made perfect." Verse 24, "To Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, and to the blood of sprinkling that speaks better things than that of Abel." So the church is the mother of us all. She's our spiritual mother. You know, there's amazing correlations and similarities between what the church should be. And when I talk of the church, I'm talking of all of us. What the church needs to be and what a mother is. A mother is loving. A mother is kind. A mother desires for their children to grow up and to be helpful people in society, to do good, to help others. A mother has a caring way about them, empathetic way about them. They nurture. They help. They heal. Those are all things that we as individuals, as part of this church, and as part of the mother of us all, need to be like that. In 1 Thessalonians 2, 7 and 8, we see how Paul felt about the church. 1 Thessalonians 2, verses 7 and 8. "Because we really should try to attain these type feelings towards one another." 1 Thessalonians 2, 7 and 8. Verse 7, this is Paul talking to the Thessalonians. It says, "But we were gentle among you, just as a nursing mother cherishes her own children." That's how we need to be thinking of each other and be gentle with each other and helpful. Verse 8, "So affectionately longing for you." Some of these characteristics we need to be with each other. "We were well pleased to impart to you not only the gospel of God, but also our own lives, because you had become dear to us." That's what Paul is saying as part of the church to those within the church. Paul treated them as a nursing mother, cherishing them, loving them, caring for them. Hebrews 10 gives us some additional functions that we, as part of the mother church, should be doing. Hebrews 10, 23 through verses 25. As part of the mother of us all, the church being a mother to us, and we being all part of that church, we need to be doing some of these things also. Hebrews 10, verse 23, "Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering. Be steadfast, for he who promises is faithful." We need to be people of faith and belief in his promises. Verse 24, "Let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together as the manner of some, but exhorting one another, and so much more as you see the day approaching." As a body, we should be like a mother is to each other. We should love and care for each other and help each other. We need to be drawing closer to each other as a mother would to a child. We ourselves, each one of us, need to be people of faith and belief. You know, mothers have an incredible impact on their children, families, and societies that are incredibly important. Whether you're a Sarah or a Jochebed, a Rahab, or part of the spiritual body of Christ, we all have an incredibly important part in each other. We can have a great impact on each other. A smile, a word, a phone call, an email, just saying, "Hey, I know you're there. I'm thinking of you." You know, Irma Bombeck writes a short illustration. I like Irma Bombeck and some of the stuff she comes up with or did come up with. But she wrote a short illustration telling about an incident in her life that changed her life as a mother forever. She writes this. She says, "For the first 4 or 5 years after I had children, I considered motherhood a temporary condition, not a calling. It was a time in my life set aside for exhaustion and long hours, and it would pass." And we've all been there who've had children. The long hours, the time, all of that. We've been there. She says, "Then one afternoon with 3 kids in tow, I came out of the supermarket pushing a cart when my toddler son got away from me. Just outside the door, he ran towards a machine holding bubble gum in a glass dome. In a voice that shattered glass, he shouted, 'Gimme, gimme.' I told him I would give him what for if he didn't stop shouting and get in the car. As I physically tried to pry his body from around that bubblegum machine, he pulled the entire thing over. Glass and balls of bubblegum went all over the parking lot. I told him he would never see a cartoon as long as he lived. And if he didn't control his temper, he was going to be making license plates for the state. He tried to stifle his sobs as he looked around at the staring crowd who'd gathered around. Then he did something that I was to remember for the rest of my life. In his helpless quest for comfort, he turned to the only one he trusted his emotions with, me. He threw his arms around my knees and held on for dear life. I had humiliated him, chastised him, and berated him, but I was still all he had." She adds, "That single incident defined my role. I realized I was a major force in this child's life." That changed her life from a temporary, just make it through it, to realizing that she was a center point in this child's life. We all have that chance to make a difference in somebody else's life. We can all be a major force in other people's lives. We can do it all through the faith and the belief that we have in God's promises. I began our message today by telling you about the names carved in that big poplar tree up the holler in northeastern Kentucky on the land that my mother and father-in-law owned. How those carvings were the carvings that told you about our lives and the loves that we had in the family. Well, those carvings are gone. That tree blew over in a big storm quite a few years ago. It's no longer there, it's gone. Several years ago, my youngest daughter and her family started a new initial tree. In that, you'll find my youngest daughter and her husband, their initials with a heart around it. You'll find my initials and my wife's initials with a big heart around it. You will find their 2 children's names written on that tree. It's the beginning of something fresh. Talks about our lives and our history and our loves that are in the family. But there is nothing even close to how we carve our lives into our children's lives and into each and every other person that we come into contact with. That's truly what's important. How do we carve the legacy that we have, the way of God's life, and how we want our children to live? How do we carve that into their hearts and into their minds? As mothers of this world and as mothers of the church, and those of us who are not mothers, we still have a great opportunity to impact others, to have an impact on them that lasts forever, through all eternity, carved on their hearts, not on the bark of trees. We all have a part of this spiritual church to be a mother to each other, to help each other, to be become spiritual mothers of faith and belief.